Hello, this is Nicole Hunter from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine, February 2018 edition. And we're just going to wrap up Black History Month with this last edition for the month. And let's just dive right in. So on in this edition, I'm going to cover Gaga for Gugu. And this is of the actress. Her name is Gugu Mbatha-Raw. You won't find Gugu Mbatha-Raw on Instagram, Twitter, or even Facebook. The British-born actress isn't interested in documenting her every move on social media. And she doesn't think anyone else would want her to either. I'm quite a private person, even though what I do is quite public, Mbatha-Raw explains. I would probably overthink it. I'd be like, does the whole world really need to know this? Am I important enough for the world to really care about what I'm doing right this second? Our answer, yes and yes. Plus her hollow of soft spiral curls, perfectly full lips, and sophisticated style seem tailor-made for selfies. But if the 34-year-old bombshell won't give us what we want on our phone screens, she's certainly delivering on the silver screen. After mesmerizing audiences as the leading lady in both Belle and Beyond the Lights, Mbatha-Raw is set to star as Dr. Kate Murray in one of the most highly anticipated films of the year. A Wrinkle in Time, Ava DuVernay directed the approximately $100 million project, which has an A-list cast that includes Oprah Winfrey, Reese Witherspoon, and Mindy Kaling. Storm Reid, a 14-year-old newcomer, plays Murray's daughter, Meg, the protagonist, as she continues to hone her ability to make or to get into character for various roles. We asked Mbatha-Raw to do similar transformations in honor of her favorite beauty icons. And some of her beauty icons actually are Billie Holiday, the late Prince, civil rights activist Angela Davis, and Egyptian queen Cleopatra. It wasn't just their beauty that attracted me to them, Mbatha-Raw says. It's good to celebrate people of substance. She does just that with the masterful touch of makeup and a striking wardrobe. With the way her career is soaring, we're certain the legacy Mbatha-Raw leaves behind will be just as stunning. Next article that we're going to cover is Strength of a Woman. So in this exclusive excerpt from the powerful new book, When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir, activist Patrice Kahn Cullors with co-author Aisha Fidel recounts the fateful night that a movement was born. I start seeing the timelines update. The killer is acquitted of the first charge, and then he is acquitted of all of them, every single one of them. I go into shock. I lose my breath. My heart drops to my stomach. I am stunned and for a moment cannot move. It is July 13th, 2013, and I have stepped away from monitoring events at the trial of the man who killed Trayvon Martin, age 17, a year and a half before. I had learned about Trayvon one day while I was at the Strategy Center in 2012. And going through Facebook, I came across a small article from a local paper. Was it Sanford's? I read that a white man, that's how the killer was identified and self-identified until we raised the issue of race, had killed a black boy and was not going to be charged. I started cursing. I am outraged. In what effing world does this make sense? I put a call out. Have people heard about 17-year-old Trayvon Martin? I have loved so many young men who look just like this boy. I feel immediate grief, and as my friends begin to respond, they too are grief-stricken. We meet at my home. We circle up, a multiracial group of roughly 15 people dedicated to ending white supremacy and creating a world in which all of our children can thrive. We process, we talk about what we've seen and experienced in our lives. We cry. I grew up in a neighborhood that was impoverished and in pain and bore all the modern day outcomes of communities left without resources and yet supplied with tools of violence. But when someone in my neighborhood committed a crime, let alone murder, all of us were held accountable. My God. Metal detectors, searchlights, and constant police presence, full-scale sweeps of kids just walking home from school, all justified by politicians and others who said they represented our needs. Where were these representatives when white guys shot us down? Were it not for the brave and determined young people who form the Dream Defenders, joining forces with the brave and heartbroken parents of Trayvon, Sabrina Fulton, and Tracy Martin, and had there not been sit-ins, protests, and occupations, and Al Sharpton, this boy's name wouldn't be on no one's tongue, save for his family and friends who loved him. Because of all this, we know and we are afraid. But still, in that prison in Susanville on July 13th, 2013, in the state that would give a desperate black boy who physically harmed no one 10 years, but a rapist 6 months, we hold on to hope. Because what else? 7 hours after it begins, the visit, Richie ends, and we head back to the motel we are staying at in this small town. Of the just under 20,000 residents, nearly half, 46%, live in one of the town's two prisons. Susanville, incorporated in 1860, was named for the child of the man who laid claim to founding it at a time when founding something was a euphemism for manifest destiny and homesteading and all the blood and death both of these wrought. Founding, a term like the phrase collateral damage, the use of which was ratcheted up in the 1990s so that they didn't have to say dead Iraqi children. But the point is that we are an 11-hour drive from Los Angeles because Susanville is deep in Northern California, farther up than the Bay Area and at the border of Nevada near Reno. And it's entirely unlike the vibrancy and wealth generally associated with our state and its outsized imagery of glittery Beverly Hills and shiny Silicon Valley. If you picture or if you saw a picture of it, West Virginia would likely come to mind before California would. But Susanville is actually more reflective of the average California town than anything that is marketed to tourists. And it looks like American towns across the rest of the country. Small and working class, except here the demographics report an extraordinary diversity, if that is diversity is distorted, like a horror house mirror or a story from the Twilight Zone. In Susanville, there is almost no one who is black and free at the same time, although a cursory reading of census reports could have you believing it's a racial kumbaya. Once a place where loggers and miners worked, today, Susanville's singular growth industry is prisons. Roughly half of all the adults who live here work at one of the two facilities. Of course, those numbers intensify wildly if you count the work done, the labor extracted from the prisons, who are shipped here predominantly from L.A. County from the Bay. Being here, looking at the storefronts, the people, it feels like we are trapped in a black and white photograph from the Deep South in the 1950s. And the images of hard rural living come stuttering back as it is taught us that freedom has never arrived and won't. All you can feel are the walls and the bars, the gun towers and barbed wires, which is only offset by all the military, the random appearance of soldiers who are based near Susanville, the sense of impending war, the American flags in every size you can imagine. What must it be like to live hoping for and investing in war and crime? Because without them, the people of Susanville must believe that the world would collapse. On the way back to the motel, we stop at a small store to buy microwavables. There are no restaurants and we want to eat in. Plus, this is cheaper. We buy pre-made chicken sandwiches or something like that. We are trying to be healthy. The motel has a microwave. We eat and we get on my laptop, eating and waiting for the verdict to come in. I go on my Facebook page because that's where everyone is updating what's happening. I am nervous, but Facebook keeps me connected. And then it happens. I start seeing the timelines update. The killer is acquitted of the first charge, and then he is acquitted of all of them, every single one of them. I go into shock. I lose my breath. My heart drops to my stomach. I am stunned and for a moment cannot move. When I begin to move, I go into denial. No, this is impossible. Wait a minute. Hold on. This doesn't make sense. But as soon as I deny it, I know that it is true. I am overcome with embarrassment and shame. How could this happen? Why couldn't we make this not happen? And then I start crying, and I feel wrong and crying. My tears make me want to hide. I feel like I have the particular kind of strong black people are always asked to be. The impossible strong. The strong where there is no space to think about your own vulnerability. The space to cry. I look around the room, this small motel room, and I look at the two women I have traveled here with. In my role as a counselor at Cleveland, I played such a particular role for them. Haywan, a junior, when Richie entered their high school as a ninth grader, embraced him as her little brother. I held them both close to me, mentored them both, trained them to be organizers for justice in our communities, organizers against the prison industrial complex, organizers for human rights. And Tanaya, who fell in love with Richie months before he was arrested, committed to him, which made me commit to her. When they decided to marry after learning of his sentence, I was the one to marry them. I had become ordained in 2004, primarily because I was determined to marry queer people despite what was then marriage. Inequity in California and the nation. As time moved forward and marriage equity took hold, my ordination and desire to marry people expanded to include all those who, for different reasons, were prevented from legally being families, including prisoners and their wives. I officiated Tana and Richie's service, their exchange of vows inside of jail, and there has not been a weekend in all the years that they've been together when she has missed seeing him. So even though I am not so much older than they are, whether Richie or Tanaya or Haywan or even Trayvon, I am old enough to feel responsible. I have become my big brother, Paul. I feel the weight of being with two black women who are younger than me in this prison town. And I wonder, if it came down to it, would I be able to protect them, protect us? Would I be able to protect them, protect us? Do I have any power to ensure that they will live long, that their black lives will be full and healthy? I cannot stop myself from crying. As much as I want to weep hard, we all do. And then I get angry. Once again, my world is defined by cognitive dissonance. To be in this town where this little boy, literally this 18-year-old boy who had hurt no one, would be locked up for 10 years, and this white presenting man could kill us and go home. And then my friend Alicia writes a Facebook post. Alicia, whom I've known for 7 years at this point, whom I'd met at a political gathering in Rhode Island, where at the end of the day, our goal was to dance until we couldn't dance anymore. She and I danced with each other all night long and began a friendship that holds us together to this very day. But she writes these words in the wake of the acquittal. BTW, stop saying that we are not surprised. That's a shame in itself. I continue to be surprised at how little Black Lives Matter, and I will continue that. Stop giving up on Black life. Black people, I never give up on us, never. And then I respond. I wrote with hashtag Black Lives Matter. Alicia and I brainstormed over the course of the next few days. We know we want to develop something. We know we want whatever we create to have global reach. Alicia reaches out to her friend Opal Tomiti, a dedicated organizer who is running Black Alliance for Just Immigration, based in Brooklyn. Opal is a master communicator and develops all this initial digital components we need to even get people to feel comfortable saying the words Black Lives Matter. For even among those closest to us, there are so many who feel the words will be viewed as separatist, that they will isolate us. Opal pulls together the architecture for our first website and Twitter account, our Facebook and Tumblr. We are determined to take public this basic concept that our lives mean something, that Black lives matter. After a few days, I return to Facebook and I begin to post. I write that we are going to begin organizing. I write, I hope it impacts more than we can ever imagine. A lighter article on this note. Love and life. Finding love at any age. Marrying your soulmate has no expiration date. Meet two new wives who said I do for the first time after turning 60. Mona Terrell and Nate Wallace. As her 50th birthday approached, New Jersey publicist Mona Terrell prepared to enjoy the fruits of her successful life as the single mother of two daughters. But the universe works in mysterious ways, and 6 months later, before celebrating the Big 5-0, Mona found herself seated next to a mysterious new guy at a work event. We met at a leadership conference. I'm a research scientist and normally don't attend. I happened to go because it was in my area, admits Nate Wallace, age 65, then a divorced father of three in Pennsylvania. When I met Nate, I'd kissed enough frogs. In our convo, we both were trying not to brag about our kids, says Mona, age 62, laughing. Turns out that one of his sons attended the same college as my daughter. We realized we had a lot in common. Having daughters to talk about was a dream come true in itself. As a teenager, Mona had been told by a doctor that bearing children would be difficult. She welcomed her two girls by an older partner when she was in her 30s. Despite an 80-mile distance separating Mona and Nate, their friendship quickly blossomed. It was nice to meet someone who understood the things that I was going through, especially with the kids. Mona was even giving me dating advice, says Nate. As things progressed, Mona found herself eagerly anticipating their conversations and sharing her troubles. At the time, I was having a health challenge. No one knew, but I decided to tell him. After months of talking, emailing, and texting, the friends finally reconnected in person for dinner at Mona's favorite restaurant in New Jersey. I was attracted to his spirit, strength, and smile, says Mona. After that date, I said, sorry, I can't help you with your other relationships anymore because I really like you. Nate accepted Mona's resignation as his wingman and 8 months later asked her to be in a committed relationship. That was the defining difference. He asked to be with me versus letting it just morph. Even though the two maintained separate homes, any time spent together was spent with love and fun. Nate would greet me with a big smile and a hug and a glass of wine when I drove to Pennsylvania. She continues, he sang love songs to me and served candlelit breakfast. Though full of romance, Nate wasn't sold on getting hitched again. I was married once and it didn't work, he says. My thing was, we're committed, let's just continue the way things are. But after 12 years, Nate had a change of heart. I started thinking, Mona always wanted to be married. I knew this was a woman I could grow with. An impromptu trip to the mall became a milestone, Mona recalls. As we passed the jewelry store, he said, let's look at rings. I thought, yeah, right, and sat while he looked. He found one and asked me to put it on. He left and continued shopping. Later, he said he wanted to return to the jewelry store. He proposed to me right there. He'd had the ring size while we had been shopping. I almost fell out. 11 months later, Mona's 93-year-old mother, Zoma, walked her down the aisle on May 20th, 2017. From the first date, I wanted this man to be a part of my life, Mona says. My grandmother used to tell me, the heart is like a magnet. You get what you call for. And the second couple is Rhonda McLean and William Craig. Rhonda Joy McLean Craig, age 65, is a woman accustomed to defying the odds. I integrated my high school when I was 13, accompanied by a sheriff carrying a gun. I finished high school at 16 and college at 19. I have two advanced degrees and have been blessed with a 40-year career, she states. However, despite her growing up in the church, her parents were co-ministers of music for more than 50 years in their North Carolina congregation. Marriage didn't rank high on her list of life goals. I was determined to save the world and didn't do much dating until my 20s. I dated and agreed to marry a man from Kenya, she says. My mother was terrified he would take me away, and for that and other reasons, we ended up breaking up. A failed engagement couldn't slow down the trailblazer. Rhonda enrolled in Yale University and, after earning her Juris Doctorate, moved to New York City to become the first black female attorney at a private firm. Once again, she was integrating a new space and weathering the storm that came with it. She worked her way up to Deputy General Counsel of Time Incorporated, the parent company of Essence. While Rhonda climbed the corporate ladder, her future husband, Craig, or William Bill Craig, age 71, was experiencing highs and lows of his own as he dealt with two marriages that ended in divorce, the first in his 20s and one in his 40s. I am absolutely a romantic. Even though they didn't work out, both unions gave the gift of children, says the proud father of two. When Rhonda and Bill finally met, the pieces fell into place. When I first saw him, I was 44 years old. I was visiting his church. I assumed he was married, so didn't ask his name. It took a couple of years before a mutual friend realized we were interested in each other. She introduced us in the fall of 1999, and away we went. Although Rhonda initially struggled with Bill's firm anti-marriage stance, over time she focused on the blessing of meeting a man who was devoted and who encouraged her to continue to lead a fulfilled life. I enjoyed that she was her own person. I was attracted to her freeness, says Bill. Then about 10 years ago, something shifted and the retired nutritionist started asking Rhonda to move into his Brooklyn home. Much to his chagrin, she refused. I was like, I have my own place. I'm in Manhattan. I'm happy to see you on the weekend. I was a busy lady, she says with a laugh. It took 5 years for her to accept. He had become my center. I wanted to come home to that every night. Bill also came to see matrimony was worth another try. I realized some time ago that I wanted to make us official and propose several times, he says. Rhonda would agree, but they never made plans until one starry night last spring. It was a quiet conversation after dinner, sitting out in the deck or on the deck that he had built at his Brooklyn house. That time, the question felt different, and so did my answer. A month later, the two exchanged vows at the Yale Club of New York City as Rhonda's 91-year-old mother, who was the matron of honor, looked on. The couple kept the guest list of 80, inviting friends they'd known for at least 20 years. He surprised me with a poem he wrote in the 1980s. There wasn't a dry eye in the place. Since then, he calls me wifey. Bill has settled into his new marriage and profoundly wears his wedding ring. I make sure to show off our connection. That is just beautiful. Again, that's love at any age. Okay, and then finally, the last article that we're going to read today is Love and Life Weight Loss. So release the weight for good. Step into a new lifestyle and shed stubborn pounds with the help of JJ Smith. Here, the nutritionist, author, and creator of the 10-Day Green Smoothie Cleanse gives us her proven habits for health. First, you need to make up your mind. If you're reading this, chances are you've hit a point where you've discovered that altering your life requires stamina, focus, and emotional support. But you won't lose weight until you transform your thinking first. One of the most challenging parts of this makeover is realizing that many of your habits are not good for you. To get results during your weight loss journey, you must hold yourself accountable whenever you revert to bad habits. Being honest during the process is just as important as detoxifying and drinking smoothies or drinking green smoothies. Oftentimes, people hear the words weight loss journey and zero in on the large gap between where they are and where they want to be. But that's exactly where you shouldn't find your attention. Success is built daily by striving for a goal and celebrating small wins along them. Redefine normal. Designed for optimal performance, the body works better than any fad if you align your actions with the body's inherent ability to heal and harness energy. You won't have to worry about weight gain. And then finally, say no to empty calories. Always choose nutrient-rich foods which are packed with vitamins, minerals, phytonutrients, fiber, and omega-3 fatty acids. And it looks like that we've run out of time for today's episode of Essence Magazine. We hope that you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Nicole Hunter, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you.